From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse answers pressing questions about healthcare. For example, do surgeons lie?
You'll be out a week, that's it. Just take the 1 week off. It was the worst pain I felt in my life.
I think that that's true. Surgeons really do underestimate what's going to happen to patients.
We cover the latest treatments and why they matter to you.
It helps them understand why they don't need chemotherapy.
On The Pulse, scientists make confessions.
I love shellfish.
That's completely impossible. It would never fit.
Sometimes we take you to scary places.
Keep your eyes closed. Never, ever open them.
And your stories are front and center.
I say it was because I was tired, but really I was just stupid. Too busy looking at my phone, and I notice, oh, I'm falling down a flight of stairs. I didn't look.
That's The Pulse, first the news from NPR. On December 6th, 2013, we were excited and a bit nervous to present a new program to you. Our name, The Pulse. Our mission, to tell stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. Our team?
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez-Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. What do we talk about on The Pulse? Well, here are the cliff notes.
Injuries to the brain due to experience.
The same neutral, blank, indescribable nothing.
There are things that you do that influence your friends, friends, friends.
Finally, it feels like I'm in med school, you know?
Robots are really just computers with motors.
I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person.
The relationship doesn't seem quite right.
Good, you feel a lot of happiness.
I'm just giving you some of the medicine through your IV.
What happened to you?
So, a few months into our existence, we thought it would be nice to reintroduce ourselves. Every week on The Pulse, we get scientists to talk about their work in ways we can all understand. We make health policy fun, really. We walk the halls with doctors and nurses, discuss breakthrough treatments, and we hear from people as they heal and cope with illness. On today's show, we're going to listen to some of our favorite stories that really spell out what we want to do with this show. Of course, we're always interested in big trends, and that's what our first story is about, a very big trend in both employment and healthcare right now. On my part, it required a wardrobe change and learning some new moves. So let's take a listen. I'm at work right now, believe it or not. I'm wearing my gym outfit, and I'm a little bit out of breath, and I'm trying my hardest to follow a Zumba instructor. Not doing very well. Up, up, left, left, wrong direction.
Mike, in. Grab some water. Have a towel.
Thank you. That's Zach Seward, Pulse Innovation Reporter. What's going on, Zach?
Well, we're talking about workplace wellness programs, which have sprouted up with a vengeance in the last decade or so. It's everything from work-sponsored biometric screenings to anti-smoking programs to health coaching, and yes, even Zumba classes. It's a wide net, workplace wellness, but as these programs become more and more popular, things are changing.
Where the market's evolved to is not just a phone call or a meeting with a coach. Now where the market's moving is into a technology realm.
Michael Rosenfeld is the president of WellNow, which is a wellness management company in Trevose, PA, just northeast of Philadelphia. When he started his company 8 years ago, Rosenfeld says workplace wellness was a different ballgame.
When we started, the industry was kind of afraid of asking their employees to disclose information, kind of an Orwellian thing. You know, I'm asking you to draw blood. I'm asking you to answer questions about your health. And they felt like that was kind of over the top.
That has changed. The Orwellian uneasiness on the part of employers has been subsumed by the bottom line realities of the rising cost of offering health coverage. Workplace wellness is now a $6 billion industry. Recent data suggests that about half of all companies with at least 50 workers have some sort of wellness program. And if you work at a really big company, it's almost certain that you have access to at least one.
Given where healthcare costs have really risen to, I need to get involved because if I don't, my costs are going to pretty much go out of control.
The backdrop for all this is the ongoing crisis state of the American healthcare market. Chronic conditions, many of which are from so-called lifestyle diseases, drive lots of spending. Rosenfeld says the idea behind workplace wellness is to help people understand the intersection of lifestyle and health. If you can give them the tools, classes, or support to make a change, they might feel better, and they might help their employer avoid costly health claims down the road. But the thing is, just how much employers are saving thanks to wellness programs is now being questioned.
We still find evidence for the programs improving health and health-related behavior. We just don't find that this saves a lot of money.
That's Soren Matke, and his report last summer for the RAND Corporation was a gut check for the workplace wellness industry. RAND, a leading policy analysis firm, was tapped by the government to do the most comprehensive evaluation of workplace wellness programs to date. Going into it, the conventional wisdom was that every dollar a company spent on wellness yielded $3 in return.
Our estimate for the Department of Labor report said at best these programs are cost neutral when it comes to healthcare cost. And actually the Pepsi study that we just published a few weeks ago showed that return on investment was only 25 cents on the dollar for their specific program.
The soda maker has a long-standing and really comprehensive program. Matke stresses that wellness programs do seem to chip away at what the RAND report called a current epidemic of lifestyle-related diseases. Think obesity, diabetes, heart disease. And even if the narrow business case for them may not be so strong, Matke says wellness programs probably aren't going anywhere. Another study last summer from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that most employers still swear by them, with the idea being that something, anything, to fight rising health costs might be worth keeping. But RAND says some employers are likely to switch gears going forward, offering more targeted ways of getting bang for their wellness buck. And that's what a handful of new wellness startups are also banking on.
Pick a character.
I'll go with Kevin.
Okay. Glad to hear that. Everyone usually goes for workaholic Wendy.
I'm sitting with John Cooper, the founder and CEO of LifeVest Health, and we're looking at a laptop with an image of the bumbling Kevin character from the sitcom The Office. He's walking me through how it all works.
We have this underlying concept of building a stock exchange for your health and treating your health like a stock that will go up and down as you improve or neglect your health.
It's all based on biometric screenings and tracking measures of your health. If your blood pressure goes down, your stock goes up. You stand to make more money. Say you light up during a lunch break, your stock goes down. You can see it on Kevin's hypothetical dashboard, money as both carrot and stick.
So what does he do? He goes to add his record that week. He, you know, mentions that he's been smoking. He saves in right away. He gets instant feedback. So it says, hey, that cost you $5. You just lost 146 days from your life expectancy.
That's bleak, man.
You know, we like to give people real-time feedback, and that's a real message, right? That's something that people can, it's something that people don't shrug off, really.
LifeVest is new to the market. The Philly-based startup relocated from Denver about a year ago. It recently signed JetBlue to its roster of a dozen or so companies. Cooper says the thing that makes them stand out in a crowded field is money.
There's a powerful association between having an investment in your health or having skin in the game, taking on a little risk, and actually affecting your behavior change.
Direct financial incentives for participating in workplace wellness programs are still quite rare, according to the studies from RAND and Kaiser. But no surprise here, they also found that cash tends to be a good motivator. Cooper says it's early yet, but his company is seeing promising engagement numbers, a partial validation of the startup's approach to workplace wellness that's firmly rooted in behavioral economics.
We use every sort of accountability tool there is out there. So we're using financial incentives. You've got competition with your friends. You've got your family who's holding you accountable. So in that sense, it is gamified, but it's not, you know, a video game for health.
But do we really want employers wielding more effective tools for coaxing us to work out? Cooper says better health is a win-win, and easing concerns around employers having too much access to personal information is a major focus industry-wide.
They can see, you know, what does my Atlanta office look like? But they don't see, you know, what does Bob in accounting look like?
LifeVest thinks it's poised to ride a wave of structural change in the healthcare landscape. The Affordable Care Act allows companies to dangle bigger financial rewards for hitting health goals and impose stiffer penalties, too. For example, the law lets companies make smokers bear up to 50% more in premiums than non-smokers. Soren Madke of RAND says aligning incentives to create better public health is probably a good thing, but thorny ethical issues are likely to emerge.
So I think many people are okay with penalizing smokers if you offer them a way out of the addiction. But if you look at obesity and eating behavior, that's a much more nuanced and complex problem.
With cash incentives, companies like LifeVest could be walking that thin line while getting us to walk more too. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
The Pulse wants to answer your questions, and in our segment, Pain in the Neck, people tell us what really irks them in their experience as patients, and we look into why the system operates the way it does and whether anyone has a fix. In this edition of Pain in the Neck, we were asked to investigate whether surgeons tell the truth.
I'm Dave Mozeleski. I had surgery where I had my adenoids removed, my tonsils, my deviated septum fixed, my palate adjusted, and that little punching bag thing cut out as well. The doctor called it the Roto-Rooter surgery. And when we were preparing for it, he told me that I'd be out for a week. Surgery would be done on a Friday, be out for the entire week, be fine after that. When I woke up the second Sunday after the surgery, thinking that I was going to be okay and going to work the next day, my throat was on fire, my nose was on fire, I was freaking out, painkillers weren't helping, my then-girlfriend, now-wife, had to call the doctor and actually get Xanax prescribed for me because I was just such a hot mess. And when she talked to the doctor on call just said, no, they should have told him he'd be out for 2 weeks solid because that surgery as an adult is just, no, it's not pleasant. It was the worst pain I felt in my life from after the surgery was that Sunday when I thought I was going back to work Monday. So I thought something was wrong. I thought the stitches came out. I thought it was an infection. And just mentally, I was just freaking out and really had to be reeled in and pulled back.
I think that that's true. I think it's real. Surgeons really do underestimate what's going to happen to patients.
You'll be out a week. That's it. Just take the 1 week off.
I'm Joe Beiske. I am the Associate Executive Director of the American Board of Surgery. I'm a surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania. You know, I was in practice for 20 years, not always emergency surgical services, the kind of practice where you saw the patient ahead of time, talked to them, did their surgery, and saw them after. And what I saw over time is it really takes a lot out of you, even minimally invasive surgery, which is the surgery with little incisions, which kind of gives the impression that it should be nothing. But it sets off a whole cascade of what's called a catabolic response, where your body perceives itself as having been attacked, and it changes how you use energy. And so people are very tired. They have pain a lot of the time, although that's very wildly variable how long that lasts. And often they get depressed. They have other side effects like loss of appetite, loss of food enjoyment, which in itself becomes depressing. And that all follows a pretty predictable trajectory. And I do think that surgeons neglect to tell their patients about it.
But why?
Why do we neglect to tell them about it? Well, they don't teach it in medical school, so you have to observe it and sort of pay attention to it. And so I kept hearing the same stories. You know, I'm so tired. I just feel like there must be something wrong. You know, why am I back to myself? And I just noticed, you know, I would see people 2 weeks after their surgery and 6 weeks after their surgery, and sometimes between if they were worried. And I was like, oh, you know what? They all get better. They all complain of that sort of 3.5, 4 weeks after their surgery. And then at 6 weeks, they're fine. And so I started telling them. I was like, you know, I don't think there is anything wrong with you. Why don't you call me in 2 more weeks? And because I think you're going to feel fine. And they would call and be like, you're right. You know, it just like lifted. I don't really know what happened. So then I started telling people, you know, it'll be 6 weeks before you really feel fully yourself.
Do you think surgeons maybe want to take people's fear away? You know, if you tell me beforehand, you're not going to feel well for 6 weeks, I might think, ugh. Do I want to really do the surgery at all?
So I did actually have patients. You know, some people go around and interview a lot of surgeons before they have surgery, especially for elective surgery, which is fine. And occasionally I would have someone come in. I'd say, you know, 2 weeks out of work, 6 weeks before you fully feel yourself for this operation. And that does vary according to the operation to some extent. And they'd say, well, you know, the guy down at the other hospital told me, you know, 2 days out of work and, you know, I'd be fine in a week. So why should I come to you? And I was like, it's not a difference in the operation, you know, it's a difference in the preparation. So I don't know. I do think that surgeons as a breed, You know, we kind of take it on the chin ourselves. You know, most of us trained in an era of time when you worked 120 or 140 hours a week. There's a lot of self-sacrifice. You went to work sick. You went to work in pain. You went to work on crutches when you broke your leg. So I think there's a little bit of a, I can do it, you can do it too. And I think we generally don't see people in the suffering phase. It's not that it's malevolent or reckless. I think it's just somewhat uninformed. We have this like, you're going to be fine, you're going to be fine, you're going to be fine. And they are going to be fine. It's just going to take them a little bit longer than they expect.
Are surgeons as a group talking about this? Is there any interest in maybe informing patients better or having longer conversations?
I'm going to have to say no. It's just, you know, they just don't perceive it as really a problem. As long as in the long run you're okay. And as long as you've got some sort of way to take care of yourself, you know, no surgeon likes to discharge a patient to home alone. Most hospitals don't really allow that. There's supposed to be someone to be with you. And so we just figure someone will take care of it. They'll get better. We'll hear about it if they don't get better. That's sort of where it lies. I don't think there is much thrust on better education.
So do you have any advice for patients who are going into surgery? So if the surgeon says this, and maybe they're hearing from other people who've gone through that surgery who say a totally different thing, where do I find the truth?
Well, so you should listen to your friends who've been through something similar, because most surgeons have not had all the operations that they do. Everything should be taken seriously. You should count on it taking longer to recover than you think it will. And you cannot win by pushing. You can't win by pushing. You have to relax and let nature take its course. So, you know, again, I would say 2 weeks before you can really functionally do a good job at a desk job, longer if you do a physical job, 6 weeks before you're really truly yourself again.
That's Joe Bieske from the American Board of Surgery. What's your pain in the neck, that thing that really annoys you about doctors' offices, hospitals, insurers? Email us at thepulse@whyy.org. Coming up, we love science, and we don't have to curse to make that point.
That's it. I've never, ever wanted to be anything else.
I love these dogs.
I've never seen anything like this happen before.
A story of ancient bones reunited, and we'll meet the next generation of super dogs. That's coming up on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. It's a few months into the life of the show, so today we're taking some time to reintroduce what we do. Part of our mission is to talk about science, but not like this.
A macro-level analysis of SRL processes and their relations to the acquisition of a sophisticated mental model of a complex system.
No, thank you. Instead, we created a science talk setting that's more like a cocktail party, where one guest asks the other, "So, what do you do?" We pair up a layperson with a researcher for some down-to-earth conversations about science, sans the cocktails, regrettably. And here's one such conversation that we especially enjoyed. It's about malacology. Public health student Tegan Keating sat down with malacologist Amanda Lawless and asked her, "So, what do you do?"
I am a scientist at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University. My background is actually in marine science. I don't work with sea turtles. I don't swim with dolphins. And I have never seen a whale in person. And
really?
That's usually what people think when I say that I'm a marine scientist. But actually, my passion has always been with things without backbones. So things like shells, crustaceans, crabs, different things like that has always been what has fascinated me the most. It's really awesome for me to be able to work at the Academy and to work in their Department of Malacology, which is where I work now.
Malacology?
Exactly. So I even had to look it up myself when I first came here, because So malacology is the study of mollusks. We study the animal and the shell itself. A mollusk in general is just a soft-bodied animal that's able to produce a shell. The shells are made out of calcium carbonate. But the tricky thing is that not all mollusks have shells. So it isn't a defining characteristic. Your slugs that invade your garden, or after a rainstorm you might see them crawling across the sidewalk, those are actually mollusks. They just don't have their shell anymore. If you look really close, some of them have tiny little shells that look like saddles on their back. And some of them have evolved not to have shells anymore. Octopus and squid are mollusks as well.
They have their shells inside, don't they?
Right. So squid have internal shells, but octopus used to have shells. In the fossil records, we can see that they used to have shells, but today's octopus don't have any remnant of a shell anymore.
How did you get interested in mollusks and their shells? Was there something, like when you were a kid, that was really interesting and exciting to you about these creatures?
I've never wanted to be anything else. The first time I ever saw the ocean and I saw, you know, live animals in the water, and you're just like, how do I work with that? My mom was like, oh, you got to be a marine biologist. I was like, that's it. That's what I'm going to be. And it's so cheesy, but that's it. I've never, ever wanted to be anything else.
And if you love the life in the water, I would imagine that scuba diving or snorkeling for 6 hours a day is like the best thing that you could possibly do with your time.
Absolutely. Being slightly biased, since I'm from the marine camp side, I was like, oh, you know, land snails, you know, who cares about land snails? But then you get to look at them and you're just as amazed by them and what, you know, the colors that they have. And this right here, this large shell here, is actually a land snail. And you wouldn't think that something this large, would be crawling on land.
That's like six inches long?
Yeah,
8 inches
long? Yeah,
and they
get bigger than this. This is the giant African land snail.
If I saw that snail on a sidewalk somewhere, I would be very concerned and upset.
Calling the USDA, because this is an invasive species here in the United States. If you saw one of these crawling across, there's posters up and numbers that you should call about this.
Really?
Yeah. So this is an invasive that was a big deal in Florida not too long ago. The first one was introduced here by a little boy who brought it back as a pet on an airplane from overseas, made it through customs somehow, and then his grandma decided that he couldn't have it in the house anymore and that they should release it. And he happened to have a female who had eggs, who had laid those eggs, and these will eat just about anything. So they can decimate an area. They'll eat other snails, they'll eat plants, they'll eat garbage. But the other bad thing about these is that they're also disease carriers. They can carry a worm that, if you were to contract that, will cause brain damage. It goes straight to your brain. And so
they're the worst snails ever to have just
not in Africa.
No, not in Africa. Here.
Not where they belong.
Right.
But here, yes.
I have one more question for
Absolutely.
You. Do you eat shellfish?
I love shellfish.
You do eat them?
I do. Mussels, clams, oysters, squid, octopus. You know, granted, not shellfish, but mollusks. I do. I love them. I don't know. I guess I love them all around. Is that horrible? I love eating them, studying them.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Absolutely.
This is fascinating.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Hey, little boy, what you got there? Did you find it in the sandy ground? Is it
Public health student Tegan Keating speaking with malacologist Amanda Lawless from the Academy of Natural Sciences. And if you want to see that invasive African land snail that can infect your brain with damaging parasites, sure, I want to see that. Go to whyy.org/thepulse. Let's move away from slimy, spineless creatures out to get us, because science is even more fun when it involves puppies. We visited the Penn Vet Working Dog Center, where one group of eager puppies is learning to detect cancer. Dr. Cindy Otto, a veterinarian who directs the center, explains.
They work in a laboratory, and samples are brought into them, and they are then screening those samples to tell whether or not there's evidence of the odor associated with ovarian cancer.
Do you have gloves?
No.
In the lab, five clear containers are lined up against the wall. A young Springer Spaniel named McBain comes in. His mission? Find the one sample that has cancer cells in it.
Good job, bud. Come here, Beanie. Oh, you...
So what did he just do?
So just now he went through, the first time he was just still a little too distracted, so we pulled him back and had him start over, and then he sniffed the samples, and when he put his nose on the one that had the cancer samples, he sat. And that's exactly what we want him to do.
Back in her office, Dr. Otto explains that the dogs are helping them detect if ovarian cancer has a smell, which could eventually lead to the development of an artificial nose, or e-nose, that would sniff out cancer in samples at a much larger scale and at a lower cost. So it could mean an inexpensive way to screen for ovarian cancer.
Because we know the dogs have a better sense of smell and ability to differentiate the confounding odors. So we think the dogs are going to help make a test that is going to be more widely available.
Can the dog detect something that a scientist couldn't see under a microscope, or can the dog do something that a person cannot?
Based on all the evidence, yes. We think that the dog's sensitivity, not only in his nose and ability to pick up very low levels, but again, to filter out all of the miscellaneous smells that when the scientists look at it, they look at it and they look at the chemical signature using gas chromatography and mass spectrometry, and they try to separate out these chemicals into their individual components. And when you're talking of hundreds of thousands of chemicals in a sample, it's really hard to parse that out. And so the dogs almost act like a sieve to help us figure out, is it this group of chemicals versus that group of chemicals? And that's what we're going to be working with the chemist to try and help them narrow down the focus, because the dogs can do that naturally because they're using their brain as well as their nose.
And what is the sample made of that you're using in the cancer detection?
So for our initial training, we're using actual ovarian cancer samples, so tissue that's been taken from patients that had ovarian cancer. And so we're teaching the dogs to recognize the smell of ovarian cancer. The next step, though, is to move to plasma samples, so blood samples that have been collected from these patients, and comparing those to patients that have ovarian disease, but it's not cancerous, and then comparing those to control patients. And so trying to get those dogs to recognize what it is that's very unique and only in the samples with ovarian cancer.
And can we smell this as humans?
No, I don't think that we can. There are certainly some diseases that we can smell. I think a lot of people have been able to recognize the ketones associated with diabetes, and that's a pretty obvious smell. But what we're talking about is something that is so minuscule in the blood or being, you know, exhaled in the breath or from the skin that there is just no way that we can smell the things that we're looking for.
If I'm a person getting screened for cancer, what might that look like in 5-10 years if this research is successful?
Right now, our focus, again, is on ovarian cancer. We believe that different cancers are going to have different odors. Certainly, 10 years down the line, maybe we'll find something that's common in all cancers. That would be wonderful, but probably not as logical, given that cancers are so different from different tissues. For ovarian cancer, our ultimate goal would be that a person could even collect a urine sample and ship it off every 6 months to be screened. So very simple, very, you know, painless process, and you just know that, you know, your sample comes up negative, and if there's any positive, then you go to your doctor and you get a full examination and you get the more aggressive screening like ultrasounds and even CT scans.
There seems to be a lot of excitement about this work. Do you think that's because we are, for the most part, a very dog-loving society, or is it something that these dogs bring that is fascinating to people?
I think there's so many levels that it's exciting. The capability of what dogs bring to us is endless, and we do love dogs, and we kind of like, why do we like dogs so much? And part of it is because they can communicate things to us that we just don't understand but enrich our lives. And then this becomes a tangible thing that they can communicate and save people's lives. It also is a little bit Star Trek-like. It's kind of like, how did they do that? How did they have that capability when we don't? So it is an exciting area.
Dr. Cindy Otto is a veterinarian and heads the PennVet Working Dog Center. And since I know you want to see pictures of those puppies, they are smart and cute, we put them up at whyy.org/thepulse. Here at The Pulse, we love science because it makes the future happen. For example, scientists at Pennsylvania State University are the first to create tiny motors or nanomotors that fit inside a living human cell. This breakthrough in basic science is an advancement on a long road towards someday deploying microscopic robots inside the body to hunt down and treat illness. How cool is that? Tanya English reported this story.
To really understand what these new nanomotors are like, completely throw out the notion that a motor is a loud, hulking thing. Instead, think of the stripped-down basic definition. A motor is simply any machine that supplies power to propel something else. Chemistry professor Tom Malouk has created motors that are elegant, slim, and very, very small.
So they're the same size as a bacterium.
Nanomotors are not new. Scientists have been tinkering and improving them for nearly a decade.
You can make these things go really fast. You can make them spin around. They're like a bunch of bumper cars running around aimlessly.
Earlier motors were gassed up using certain fuels which are toxic to humans. Since then, researchers have figured out how to use ultrasound to power microscopic gold metal rods. Once you crank up the power, the sound waves bounce off the metal rods, which then ram and prod cells along.
Think of it as a sound wave going this way, smack, and then another one, smack, that way. So it's boom, boom, boom.
So this is what's new. Malouk and his team have learned how to slip their motors inside living cells under a microscope. So now the gold rods don't just usher cells along. These new nanomotors ricochet around inside, crashing into subcellular structures.
One of the things that we observe and we don't understand yet is if we tickle the cell someplace, it giggles somewhere else.
It's kind of like that little hammer that the doctor uses to test your reflexes. Nanomotors could be a new tool to let scientists poke around inside a cell and see what happens. Lots of people working in the field of nanoparticles say they're inspired by the 1960s sci-fi film Fantastic Voyage. In the movie, a medical crew and their submarine are shrunk down to the size of a red blood cell and then launched inside a patient's body.
Four men and a beautiful girl, off on a fantastic voyage, exploring an unknown universe, unknown dangers.
Tom Malouk says even with all its camp and bad special effects, the movie is a pretty good way to imagine what nanomotors might accomplish someday. For example, one of Malouk's good friends is a brain surgeon.
I would like to make his life easier. I would like to, instead of having the patient with his, you know, cranium sawed open, it would be really nice if the patient could just sit in a comfortable chair. And instead of having a scalpel and everything, we just inject into his arm through a syringe, say 100 million of our nanomotors.
Malouk says instead of standing in a surgery suite, the doctor would sit at a video game console and send out future generation nanobots to deliver medicine or maybe puncture cancer cells.
So that would be the dream. What we'd like to do is work on the pieces of that dream.
And that's what's next. While Penn State refines its nanomotors, powered by ultrasound, other scientists are working on propulsion, are thinking about ways to make sure all this new technology is truly compatible with the body and safe.
You know, you don't want anyone promising quick cures for cancer or anything like that. It's fundamental research.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You can see a video of these nanomotors at work at whyy.org/thepulse. I think we've established here on The Pulse that scientists do amazing things all the time. Can we up the ante? We sure can. We now present to you a once-in-a-million-years kind of story, one that stunned even seasoned paleontologists.
Look at that perfect fit.
And we just kind of sat there for a couple seconds in silence, taking this in, like, this is impossible. This can't really be happening.
The story involves two pieces of an ancient puzzle. Puzzle piece number one looks a bit like a club.
In my hands is the bone, which is probably about 14 inches long and a big head on it that would fit into the shoulder socket of the animal.
That's Ted Dashler, curator of paleontology at the Academy of Natural Sciences. The piece of bone he's holding was once part of the upper arm of a giant sea turtle, which lived about 75 million years ago. Naturalist Louis Agassiz wrote about the bone fragment in 1849 after seeing it in the Academy's collection. But Dashler says the museum never knew exactly when or where the piece was found.
The only data that was with the specimen was Cretaceous of New Jersey.
So all that was known was that this bone had been at the Academy at least since 1849. Fast forward to 2012, a hobbyist digging in creek beds in central New Jersey finds a piece of bone and brings it to the New Jersey State Museum. The curator there thinks the find looks like it could match another piece of bone he had seen many years before in Philadelphia. Paleontologist Jason Schein was at the State Museum that day.
And the rest of us there laughed when he said that, thought, haha, that's hilarious.
A few weeks later, Schein was headed to Philadelphia anyway, so he brought along the piece of bone. At the Academy, he lined it up with the Philadelphia bone, and they fit. Ted Dashler says there is no doubt about it. These two pieces make a whole.
It's not only that the broken surfaces fit one another, but the anatomy of the bone, the diameter, the shape of that shaft. There's even gnaw marks from a shark on one end of it that you also get on the other end of it as well.
Jason Schein is still blown away.
To call this a once-in-a-lifetime experience would be selling it short, because this has never happened before. We've done our research, and to the best that we can tell, this is completely unprecedented.
This is the only bone of this species that has ever been discovered, and based on having the whole arm bone, they now estimate that the giant sea turtle was 10 feet long. Coming up on The Pulse, we revisit a thrilling sonic journey.
When I was in there, I panicked.
Stay tuned to this special edition of The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Today, we're doing a bit of soul-searching here on The Pulse. You know, thinking about what we're all about and listening back to some of our favorite segments. We really want to capture the sounds of science and healthcare, which our next story does really well, almost to the point of being panic attack-inducing. Let's head inside an MRI machine.
Oh, it's noisy. Very, very noisy.
It's sort of like being in a trash can while somebody is running a jackhammer.
It sounds like a washing machine with nuts and bolts in it.
It's just noisy. I don't know how else to describe it.
The most important thing it requires is to be still. There's a lot of loud noises, which sound strange, but I find when I hear the noises, they come with a certain beat, and it usually reminds me of some song. In fact, it's even possible with some creativity to make the sounds mimic a certain song. I'm professor of radiology, Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. An MRI is a method of getting pictures inside a body. It uses a magnet and it uses radio waves. So there are similarities in the physics of it to a radio that you'll listen to. But instead of detecting signals from a radio station and turning it into voice or music, this is using radio waves when a person is inside a magnetic field to make sophisticated images.
Still have about 20 minutes left.
When I'm in there, I just close my eyes and relax.
When I was in there, I panicked. I was just, stop, stop, you gotta get me out of here, because the fact that I felt closed in and the fact that the noise was just nothing that I had expected. I had to make them stop, and I didn't go back in. I regret the fact that I had to leave, because I'm trying to get better. I want to be free from this pain.
It is the most effective and versatile method for looking inside a human body.
Wait, here it is. This is it. I'm trying to get my bracelet off. You have to be metal-free when you go in to get the MRI. One thing I advised is to keep your eyes closed. Never, ever open them.
So you lie on a table and it slides you inside a cylinder.
I always keep my eyes completely closed because you don't want to see how close you are to that machine.
We are told not to move and not to speak while the scan goes on.
I pray. And I prayed my whole way through it.
What I did while I was in there the last time to get through it peacefully was to meditate.
Try to think of a journey that you're going through, something that you love to do. The sun coming through the ivy and the trees, the nature, you see the animals, deer.
As thoughts come up, just letting them go, and as the sounds come up, just sort of let them be part of the breathing.
It will take away the anxiety.
It's a strange experience, but there's nothing to be scared about.
You can do this because the end result is for you to get healthy. My name is Tony Upmorta.
I'm Dr. Donald Mitchell.
My name is Janet DeSimone.
My name is Jerry Whalen.
That audio tour was produced by Alana Gordon, and all the music featured in this piece was inspired by actual MRI sounds. We've put a playlist of MRI songs on our website at whyy.org/thepulse.
Take a picture, what's inside?
I say this every week on the show. We'd love to hear from you. Please email us. Email us your feedback. Send us your questions. And we hope that you write to us because you are a big part of the show. One of my favorite segments is Patient Files, which explores your stories of illness, recovery, and coping. Let's listen to one of them. Here, 25-year-old filmmaker Scott Clifford talks about what it's like to live with a rare genetic disorder.
I have osteogenesis imperfecta, which is a genetic disorder. Affects the bones, makes them brittle. The plan or however your brain's supposed to make collagen is just defective from the start. It keeps going like, oh, that's bad bone, let's make some more. It's just going to keep making bad bone. It's like a vicious cycle. When you break your bones, they heal, obviously, but they don't heal like normally, like a normal person. They tend to not heal straight. Even if you try and realign the bone, it still tends to heal crooked. It doesn't, just because of the way the collagen is. So, for example, I have a really bad bend on my left arm because I broke it a lot when I was younger. If you look at my lower legs, my tibias, they're bent a little bit at the end as well. So if you see me on the street, you'll see, for example, my left arm has a pretty bad bow to it. I have what they call a barrel chest, which just means that the ribs curve out more than a normal person. There are many different types. My type is type 3, which is more severe, but not the most. Knock on whatever you want, I'm still around, so. If I had to do it in one word, I would say I'm a filmmaker. I was busy trying to shoot my junior thesis when my lead actor dropped out, so I had to scramble to find another lead actor. I hadn't slept for, well, I want to say 2 to 3 days, just been doing all the work, and we met up at the library. I say it was because I was tired, but really I was just stupid. Too busy looking at my phone, and I noticed, oh, I'm falling down a flight of stairs. I didn't look. I was just casually rolling off the stairs. So I fall down pretty much face first under the ground, which is, it's funny now, but it wasn't so funny then. The pain wasn't too bad yet because of the adrenaline, but I had a hard time moving. I get in the stretcher, which is always tougher because, you know, when you have a rare condition like I do, you have to really stand up for yourself to tell them how to how they need to handle you, because it's not the same as a normal able-bodied person. And so that's a problem a lot of people in my condition have, because you have to be, I don't want to say strong enough, I don't think it's the right word, but strong enough to really stand up for yourself at literally like the worst moment possible when you don't want to stand up for anything. And then it gets into, well, you know, we're giving you like pain medication. I've had so many surgeries throughout the years that like morphine doesn't work for me anymore. So I have to convince them that they need to give me something stronger than morphine. And try not to sound like you're just a drug addict looking for a fix. A lot of kids with my condition like to give numbers out. And you see headlines on newspapers going like, kid with, you know, rare condition breaks 400 bones in lifetime or 300 bones in lifetime. I don't like to count that because I don't view that as my life. I can't really give you a solid number. I can say that my family told me that they stopped counting when it reached 50 when I was 8. My philosophy for my disability is pretty simple. It's to try and live the life that I want despite the obstacles. Unfortunately, I have a lot more obstacles than most. That's just reality. I'm a person trying to do their best with flaws like everyone else.
That's filmmaker Scott Clifford, and Jeanette Woods produced this piece. A lot of you have shared your stories with us for Patient File, so let's hear one more. This one features a woman, a comedian, whose medical issue forced her to reject most of her culinary heritage.
I'm Valerie DeMambro. I live in Philadelphia in Queens Village. I am a stand-up comedian and storyteller in the city of Philadelphia.
Oh my god, ricotta cheese pie, that's like the best thing in the world, but I definitely can't eat that anymore because the crust is like the best part of that. This is probably like a tiramisu or something, I guess, right? Do you guys have any gluten-free offerings?
Not at all.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Thank you.
Hi. Well, I moved from New York to Philadelphia in 2010. It was a super stressful time in my life. I was married for 2 years, and my husband at the time had spent most of my money. So I was broke, I filed for divorce, was laid off from my job, and found bed bugs, all within a 3-week period of time. So all signs were pointing to I needed to move back home with my parents, according to my mother. But I started having extreme stomach issues. Not only that, I was extremely lethargic. I was waking up with numbness in my arms and legs, and I started to gain weight. And I didn't know why, because I'd been exercising a lot more. So the conversation kind of went like this. The doctor was like, hey, Val, how long has your stomach been hurting you? And I was like, well, doc, 9, maybe 10 years. So he just kind of looked at me and decided to run some tests. And about a week later, I got the diagnosis, and it was celiac. And I was all like, celiac who? Because I'd never heard of this before. I had no idea what he was talking about. Apparently, at some point in my life, and mostly because of the stress of the prior 6 months, because that's what happens with celiac, I became intolerant of gluten. I was diagnosed a wheat racist, which was a very weird moment in my life. I'm Italian-American. I grew up Italian-American. So I was raised on a steady diet of things like pasta, bread, chicken,
breaded chicken, breaded fried cheese, breaded fried vegetables, cannolis, the Godfather, Mario Lanza, you know, and a healthy side of guilt. That was basically what my life was like. So being gluten-free meant being gone of all of the delicious things on that list. I was basically ignoring Clemenza's advice from the Godfather, you know. I was taking the gun but leaving the cannolis, so it made no sense. My grandmother would just look at me with disappointment and threaten me with guilt and just like, just eat the macaronis, I could be dead tomorrow. And I'm not saying that my refusal of gluten's killed my grandmother. I'm only saying that she just happened to die 1 month after I told her I could no longer eat her raviolis. I just turned into a completely different person. I no longer, you know, had comfort foods. I'd be freaking out and I couldn't even have like macaroni and cheese. You know, the only thing that this restaurant would have for me is a freaking salad. And if they brought it with a crouton on it, I was literally going to, you know, explode in the middle of the restaurant.
My name is Brett Hopkins. I'm working at the Flying Monkey Bakery in the Reading Terminal in Center City, Philadelphia. I try to keep everything listed as gluten-free items. We can't call them gluten-free because we're open-aired, so we make everything noticed as flour-free because we don't put any flour in the production of the products.
What would you recommend?
Our flourless macaroon, which is on the other side behind me, has coconut, egg whites, sugar, and almond extracts. The flourless chocolate cake is chocolate, butter, eggs, sugar, cornstarch, salt.
Yeah, I am going to get a macaron.
Total is 125
Thank
out
you.
Of two.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie.
I don't know. I guess I'm free from gluten, but it feels more like free from flavor, you know, free from joy. I get it. It's also free from pooping in my pants. But, you know, that seems like a really small price to pay for a really good slice of pizza.
Valerie DiMambro is a Philadelphia comedian and storyteller. Sophie Reed produced this story. That's our show for this week, the grand tour of The Pulse, which is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Laura Benchoff is our intern. Our engineers are Charlie Kyer and Al Banks. Joel Patterson is our assistant producer. Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.